Good evening. It is about time to get started here. Welcome to this, the third session dedicated to making sense of the music of hymnody to hymnody and the idea of musical signification, of musical meaning. I have seen most of you before. You will know who I am and generally what we're up to here, but I am Peter Mercer Taylor, a music historian at the University of Minnesota. I work on classical music and I work on popular music, and increasingly these days I find myself working in my scholarship on hymnody as well. And I'm especially interested in the kinds of questions we're facing this week, just what the music of hymns has to contribute to what the words of hymns are all about. To ask the question, does the music of hymns help in any way to get across the meaning of the words? And as we've seen already in the course of these conversations this week, indeed it does. Sometimes in very fleeting ways, we've looked at the phenomenon of tone painting. If you make a reference to something ascending and the melody goes up, or you descend and the melody goes down, or you talk about a kingdom without end and we get a five-note melisma, sort of drawing out the word kingdom. There are very kind of primitive, straightforward ways in which music can help bolster the meaning of the words of hymns, but there are subtler ways as well. And we've looked at a couple of cases in which the music of a hymn really has changed in some fairly fundamental ways what we understand the text to be about. If there's a reference to the blood of Jesus, do we look at this as kind of a ceremonial celebration of the risen Christ and his celebration in the Eucharist? Or are we thinking instead of something much more kind of incarnational, about the blood in our own veins, something like that? We've looked at such issues from a couple of different angles. Today we're taking on a somewhat more ambitious project than either of these. And for one thing, you will all need hymnals. So if you didn't grab one on the way in, we've got several of them sitting around. There also is a pile of them outside the door. And perhaps we could bring a few more in. We may need them. But tonight what we're exploring are ways in which the music and the words of hymns interact on a broader scale than anything that we've examined thus far. I don't recall quite how I put this in the blurb that's out there on the kiosk, the blurb for this discussion, but it has to do with the way in which musical syntax on the grand scale, how an entire tune in its unfolding can help contribute to the communication of the poem, of the text on the grandest scale. So we're not just talking anymore about a single word or about a single phrase, about a single moment of tone painting, rather trying to come to terms with what tunes on the large scale are capable of doing. I want to begin by singing a tune unaccompanied as it appears in this hymnal, O Come, O Come, Emmanuel, on page 257. This is a curious case in that it is a tune based very directly on Gregorian chant. This tune has a kind of interesting history that was obscure for a long time. Recently, documents have come to light about exactly what convent the tune probably originated in. We're running through none of this, just to say, it is a 15th century piece of chant, a piece of Gregorian chant. Although we do have an accompaniment for this piece, of course, that is, if he wanted to, Bjorn, our capable accompanist, who's been helping out all week, could open his accompaniment edition of this of the hymnal and play the four-part accompaniment that is provided. I would like not to do that. I want to sing this as the piece of chant that it is and meditate on what the entire chant seems to have to do with with the words, what the entire melody does to affect the way we hear the words, as I think it does. Bjorn, could you just give us an E or an E minor chord to get started? So that's going to be our first pitch. Here we go, let's just sing the first verse.
Oh, come, oh, come, rejoice!
this tune? What's dramatic about it? What do you make of it? And perhaps we're already ready to settle on the question of what it has to do with the words. Perhaps there's just something about the tune you'd like to get off your chest. What do you make of it?
It's one I hear after I leave church in my...
Right, one that sticks with you. Yeah. Obviously a tune of enduring popularity. It's one of the good ones, one of the keepers. We don't have any bad 600-year-old tunes in this book. If they've made it this far, it's worth the trip.
And we're remembering, of course, many times in our life having heard and seen this music
right.
played and seen the setting.
Yeah.
So as soon as you have seen, as long as the first couple of notes, you're already there.
Right. Absolutely. That suddenly we're enmeshed in, a host of memories. We suddenly come in this sort of unmediated contact with our, with our own past, with our own childhood, perhaps, and we remember all of this.
I have visions of what the church is supposed to look like, too. You know, it's supposed to be candlelit and in preparation for, in Advent. It's,
great.
It's the preparation for the Christmas.
Yeah. And the fact is, we don't have all that many Advent hymns, and this is, it's sort of a towering, presence among Advent hymns generally. And there's something about that austerity, that kind of calm before the storm or something, that comes across especially powerfully if we think about, if we sing this without its harmony, if we sing it as a piece of chant. Is that a...
It's a minor key. It's kind of a haunting. And I don't know, there's so many of the Hebrew songs are in minor keys. Is there a
right.
reason that it's kind of sacred?
It's a great question. But this is cutting straight to, the issue at hand.
There's a historic connection to the fact that this is still going on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been sung this way for all this time.
Yeah.
So we have this bridge back to the people who sang it way back.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
So there's a whole lot of freight that goes with it.
Absolutely.
That's part of that history.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. I mean, there's this sort of ceremonial sense in which we're taking part, joining this host of all who've come before, who have sung this thing.
It also seems to me kind of prayerful, a request.
Mm-hmm.
Simple.
How so? Can you say more about that? What makes it seem like a request?
Well, the words, but also it is quiet, it is meditative, it is, I don't know, it's the way that the notes flow, the fact that it's in a minor key,
mm-hmm.
it's not a jumping up, cheerful kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's more like a prayer. Maybe.
Great. It jumps up a little, doesn't it?
Yeah,
I mean,
it jumps
up for this sort of rejoice part.
Yeah.
Right. But the whole thing sort of lingers in this. The sort of lower throes of its minor key. This is exactly what I want to ask us to focus on just for a moment, is what this minor key really has to do with things. Many of us will be totally at ease talking about particular pitches. Some of us a little less familiar with such things. We've got to talk about particular pitches. We see that the first note there out of our mouths is this thing on this line. It's called an E. Down there, the bottom line, oh, come, that first note we sing is an E. And we notice that that's also the tune on, or the pitch on which the tune ends, oh, Israel. That, this frequently happens. We begin on what we call the tonic, the kind of home pitch of the piece. We also end on the home pitch of the piece. We almost always end on it. We often begin on it, though that's less important. There are two spaces in this text, aren't there? I mean, two different principles. There is, on the one hand, Israel. There's the, captive Israel, which is in part what this is about, but it's also about Emmanuel, the God with us, who is on his or her way, probably a he in the minds of the folks who wrote this thing. So we have these two different things laid out, between which there's a distance. And I want to set out, suggest that one way we can understand that difference, the gulf that makes this an Advent hymn, not a Christmas hymn, is the fact that Emmanuel and Israel are not together yet. Emmanuel hasn't come. Israel is still in a state of waiting. Emmanuel is still this kind of remote thing for which Israel is hoping. And this, I want to suggest, is got across in little things like this note E, and in certain other little pitches. The question I want to ask is where the melodic lines end. You know, we have this phrase, and it ends here. On the page, I'm seeing it a little lower, but on the page, it looks like a G. It's up here. Da 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 da. That phrase ends down here. Da 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 da. That one ends down here on D. Da 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 da. That one ends up here on G. And here's what we notice: which ones end where? If we wanted to describe this space, just drive a wedge right here on this, you know, this space here, the F. And we wanted to ask ourselves, okay, let's divide the hymn into two kinds of musical phrases. Those that end in happy places, those that end in sad places. Those that end in high places, those that end in low places. Well, we have the first one, it ends low. It ends down on that E, below that sort of chasm, that wedge we've drawn. Oh come Emmanuel. The first one ends on G, on the high place. And ransom captive Israel, down on the E, even lower that mourns in lowly exile here. Until the Son of God appear, and here we are on G. Rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel, again on G, shall come to thee, O Israel, down on E. You can probably guess where I'm driving with this. We say this piece is in the minor mode, and we're not wrong. I mean, that is, on the grand scale, this is a piece we can understand to be in E minor. But phrase by phrase, it isn't. Some of it ends low, some of it's minor, and some of it actually is sort of a major. Emmanuel. There's nothing minor about that. That's in G major. That's up here. The point is, everything that refers to Emmanuel, to the coming Savior, ends on G. Everything that refers to Israel and its lowly state ends on E or D. O come, Emmanuel, G, and ransom captive Israel, E, that mourns in lowly exile here, D, until the Son of God appear, G. Rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel, G, shall come to thee, O Israel, E. This is what I'm talking about in tonight's conversation, ways in which an entire tune can sort of map out the basic principles at work in the text. Is this making sense? We have sort of two competing spaces, the Emmanuel space, the Israel space, the G major space, the E minor and below space. Then the music gets these things across. Closing thoughts on this one before we press on to...
Yeah, I find it interesting. The melody is French.
Yes.
And also from 2 centuries before, and the words are German.
Yep.
17th century.
And let us, we've got off this bus at least once in every class so far. And this was, in fact, about 15 minutes of the first class session was about. But let's go ahead and have it out. This is a wonderful observation. Where are you going with that?
Well, quite clearly, the melody came first.
Yeah.
And then some smart person decided to go ahead and take advantage of the minor tone of it,
right,
and yet created something, I mean, put the positive where he wanted to have more positive feelings, or a different change anyway.
Absolutely. So we can't speak of the nicest thing in the world like a Bob Dylan song. You got a Bob Dylan song, Bob Dylan writes the words, Bob Dylan writes the tune, Bob Dylan sings the thing. So whatever Bob Dylan wants, that's what's happened. In this case, we have a chant, goodness knows where it came from. A couple hundred years later, some German person writes some words. A while later, we're not even told when, at the bottom of the page here, at least two different translations take place. We're told this is a composite translation from at least two, and this is the result. It's this nice, elegant thing where I get to circle all the G's and the E's and say, look how nicely it works. Does this mean we really shouldn't be doing this kind of thing? I mean, if, as we've established already in earlier conversations this week, we may be talking about pure coincidence. That is, we may be talking about just happy accidents of history, happy accidents of luck, about sort of musical textual relationships that really just kind of crop up by mistake, you know, somewhere in the last 500 years in the course of getting this particular tune and this particular text together. Does that mean that this kind of sort of close analysis that I'm, you know, inviting us to do here doesn't really count, that it shouldn't be done? And I'll ask you, what do you think?
I don't think there's anything wrong with doing it whatsoever. I think it's nice to notice, because no matter what, we sing it as one, and we only know it in our particular time frame, in our lives, the way that we know it. And it doesn't matter how it was ultimately combined together. But for some reason, well, of course the words do, I mean the two do, there's an element of harmony in them. But I do find it interesting, and it is a question that I do wonder about a lot when you find them pulled together, these two things, such as Amazing Grace, the words and the melody, et cetera.
Yes, and this pre-existing melody and this pre-existing, right, absolutely.
And I know you hate mood and spirit in reference to music, but I think this does capture those things about Advent, so that might be why it's a beloved Advent. Wraps those together as we
describe. Yeah, this is my wife. She's been hearing me grind these axes.
What about the rest? Because it's kind of like the Episcopalian, we don't put those rests in there, I think, at least my church sings straight through those.
Right.
That's right.
Here's his
now, hold on, in the middle of
the No, that's right. That whole 1982 doesn't fiddle around to this. this chant notation.
Yeah, so where did the rest come in or not?
You're asking me, like, historically?
Yeah.
That's a great question. And I don't have the first idea. I mean, this is a wonderful question. Rests of the kind we're seeing here, I mean, this sort of clear sort of parsing out of things, this is not much like what 15th century notation would have looked like. And I have no idea where the first notated version of this tune is. It could well be that it didn't get written down until 1600, but there are reasons to suspect it had been around for over 100 years by then. And I just don't know. It's a very interesting question. Why do you care? Does it actually matter? This is a very interesting question.
Well, it's harder to sing when you're not used to singing it with or without
right.
rests.
Yeah. Now, do we have any interest in getting it historically right? It turns out that the source either does have rest or doesn't have rest. And let's say it does, and the Episcopalians have been doing it wrong. Should we fix it in our next hymnal? We've had this hymnal for 27 years. Time for a new one.
I'm one of these that says you got to have a little of both, because I would make a guess that it was legitimate chant going on in France before it reached.
Yes.
It might have been a Latin chant.
Right.
When you get exposed to that, it exposes you to the beauty of other Latin chant.
Yeah.
That's what we get in our way we sing it.
Yes. I couldn't agree more. I think you're absolutely right.
My guess is that for this hymnal, the prejudice is toward congregational singing. Mm-hmm. And this is the way congregations are going to sing it, because they've got to breathe.
Right.
Yeah.
And they don't know how to stagger breathe.
Right.
Like the monks would.
Right.
Yeah.
So why try to treat it like Gregorian strictly when your congregation wants to sing it?
And as long as it doesn't pause at a bad spot,
you
know, then it's no big deal.
Right. Turn to 267 real quickly. Keep your finger in 257, but turn to 267. And we have a classic case here. Who really wants to sing, "Joy to the world, the Lord is come. Let earth receive her king, let every heart." Maybe if your organist is a stickler, that's what you do. But most of us out there, most of the great unwashed singers of this hymn, just stick in an extra measure after king. Because everybody would rather sing, "Let earth receive her king, let every heart." And it swings both ways. And the point is, if we don't stick in an extra measure there, then we come out with this really sort of weird odd number of measures. But it's kind of a notational convention that, you know, you're invited, okay, pause if you want to, breathe if you need it, whatever. But, you know, now and then we stumble across things, you know, like this, where it's not clear just how seriously we have to take what's notated there rhythmically, but anyway, that's a little beside the point. Another thought.
Oh, there was just one other twist that occurred to me, and I don't know really anything about the history of this, but the current word 257 are based on old antiphons of the church that I assume go back a long time.
Yeah.
The words.
Right. Absolutely. Yes. And that's why, from the start of our conversations this week, I've tried to make the claim that if we're talking about Bob Dylan's Blowin' in the Wind, it makes a difference that it's Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan is there in the room with us. Anytime we say it, anytime we hear him say it, whatever, Bob Dylan's song. If we're listening to Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, Beethoven is there. That is, the orchestra is up there doing its very best somehow to get in Beethoven's mind, to get this thing right. They're not just making it up as they go along or something like that. It belongs to Beethoven. We're all just kind of listening in on Beethoven's interior workings with a hymn. I think most of our favorite hymns, we very likely don't have the first idea where they came from. We may not even know what century they were composed in. We may not have the first idea who wrote them. This is certainly true of me. I mean, if I were to make a list of my 30 favorite hymns, I could probably name about 15 of their composers, maybe 20. And I could probably name, you know, 12 or 14 of their the authors of the text. But these things tend to be passed on kind of anonymously. And the hymnal, I mean, the hymnal really kind of discourages us from thinking too hard about these things as historical documents. So my policy has always been, where hymns are concerned, that they're a very special thing, not like Bob Dylan's songs, not like Beethoven's songs, that they belong to us. They don't belong to Bob Dylan, they don't belong to Beethoven, they belong to the congregation that's making use of them. And yes, I mean, it is to me fascinating to think about the most ancient words that we use, the words of old antiphons that have sort of lived this long, or the tunes of Gregorian chants. Thinking, sort of pondering the oldness of them is to me helpful. It's nourishing spiritually to think about, you know, the ancient artifacts of the church versus the more recent ones. But there may be a sense in which the historicity of these things, the getting it right, you know, impulse in when it comes to art music, just doesn't count so much when it comes to hymns. The hymns are ours. And whatever means something to us, well, it means that. And there's no reason to act like it doesn't mean that.
Yeah. I think a lot of these, I mean, if you were to follow their sort, I mean, they look like a family tree. I mean, there's so many.
Yeah.
And, you know, I guess you could spend a lifetime just kind of doing that, but
yep.
I kind of question how
right.
Exercises.
Yeah. Because when we pick up the history, or the hymnal, the history isn't there. You know, the history, we can sort of go poking around in the history if we want, but, you know, the authors of these hymns, we're not encouraged to think that hard about by the layout of hymnals. You know, this is, well, perhaps this is needed here and there. But, I mean, history can be an interesting sidelight. The oldness of them, the fact that we may know people have been singing this for generations and generations, yes, that's important, but I don't think we need to dwell, I mean, unless we want to, you know, we don't have to worry too much about misunderstanding them. I think we're the ones who, you know, we're the ones who are invited to invent understanding as we go. We're invited to do with these as we see fit. They belong to every generation that's using them. Acting, at least, as though that's the case, let us press on to another tune. This one that does not appear in your hymnal, at least not in the form in which I want to look at it. This is a text and tune combination you have very likely seen before, but in an arrangement that I grew up with from the 1966 or thereabouts United Methodist hymnal, the United Methodist arrangement of Let Us Break Bread. And I want to use this particular arrangement for fairly particular reasons. It does things. Carlton R. Young is the arranger of this spiritual that had, you know, pre-existed him by at least 100 years. This is an old, old song that Carlton Young got hold of. Carlton Young, known as Sam to everybody who knows him. But here is Sam Young's arrangement of Let Us Break Bread Together. Let's give this a singing and then sort of back off and ask ourselves, again, on the large scale, how does the music help? What does the music do for the words?
Break bread together, our needs.
time. Let's sing the second verse. Here we go.
Let us bring wine together on
question is paramount. We started, this tune started life as a very simple song, as a highly repetitive spiritual in this tradition. It has been turned into something more like a piece of art music, where a very sort of literate musician spent a good deal of time trying to figure out exactly what notes he wanted to go where. And we are treating it as a whole. It's the arrangement that I want to look at, not just sort of what the piece used to be, what it started as. Yeah.
Can I ask just briefly, I don't want to take you away from your plan very much, but this really goes back to 1010, is that correct?
No. Thank you. I'm
but sorry. It's still pretty old.
Yeah, that's the meter, which is 10 syllables plus 10 syllables is what we got.
My question is, if you can help us, can we replay on how this would have been sung hundreds of years ago? I'm not sure they actually had printed music available at that time,
right.
Yet they've got this all written out here in a nice shape. How did it come together? Did you say a group of people that had memorized it?
It sort of seems to me like it might have been mid-19th century. A black folk song,
yeah.
In a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what it sounds like to me.
Yes. I suspect that's what it is. I do not happen to know the history of this precise hymn. But if we took, there are other hymns that we could take. If we take, for example, old American folk hymns that do begin to be sort of written down, fixed, in the early 19th century, but are, often tunes that people understood had been around for decades, that folks had been singing for a long, long time. Now, there are different ways this worked. And it does take us somewhat far afield of the task at hand. One way in which things were sung, and the way in which in many places, especially in the South, you'll still hear hymnody done, was with a tradition we call lining out, where everybody would have known a certain kind of circumscribed body of tunes, but you would have one person who would stand up at the front of things, and they would sort of sing an entire line, or maybe most of a line, kind of in advance of the congregation. Then the congregation would come in and they would sing it back. This is how most psalmody was done in this country through the 17th, early 18th century, and so on. But once these things kind of get in the water, people grow up singing the tunes, and this may just be too big a question to try to take on. It's a fascinating question, just how oral histories work. And, of course, in the first half of the 19th century, all kinds of hymnals were published without any tunes. The idea of a kind of sanctioned, the idea that a particular church, a sect, a denomination would sanction a body of tunes would have been a very strange idea along about 1810, 1820. You had texts, and occasionally you had tune books that would be published alongside them. So even by mid-century, you'll have a Presbyterian hymnal, which is a collection of texts, and then different people might swagger in and say, look, here's a tune book that you can use with that Presbyterian hymnal, and so sing, text number 112 to this tune, and number 137 to this tune, and so on. But the idea of these sort of coming together, most people were singing tunes as part of an oral tradition. They were singing the tunes they'd grown up with, singing the tunes that were being lined out. And this is a wonderful question. But I guess we're going to have to leave it at that for the moment. And press back to the form in which we do receive this thing, or at least the form in which I received it, as a 10-year-old there growing up in my Methodist church. This is how I knew Let Us Break Bread to go. This is the only way I'd ever sung it. And I love this hymn, and I loved it probably in ways that I might not have loved it had I heard it in, say, 1850 being sung, say, in unison by agricultural laborers or something like that, wherever the tune, might have kind of, come into being for the first time. what's to like about it? I mean, that is, how do the words and the music interact?
It's very simple in both respects.
How so? What's
in the words?
Yeah.
It's a song you can sing without looking at the
right.
page.
Yeah.
People can sing this on the way up to the communion room.
Yeah.
Without hauling a hymnal.
Great. Because we do have a refrain, you know, when I fall on my knees to the face of my face to the rising sun, Lord, have mercy on me. You know, that's the same every time. And then otherwise we just got a few words from you.
I think the words really kind of create then a community among those who are singing it. Which kind of let us break bread together and sort of address this kind of community and then focuses on God at the last
the last line. Terrific.
Yeah. Well, I think the parts reinforce that because it's really beautiful the way the harmony,
yeah,
different voices, the sound of different voices building community around the theme of the, you know,
yeah. And this has always plagued me. And if we go to the end of the first, second system, you know, we have these quarter notes which are obviously and sort of echoing harmonies on our knees.
Yeah.
That's how, you know, who can't sing it that way? Who doesn't want to sing this hymn in parts?
Yeah.
I suspect that Sam Young intended this to be a unison hymn and that's just going on the piano, but who needs him? I mean, we, you know, why?
Well, the parts are there.
Yeah, the parts are there and we want to sing. Yeah.
There's a different feel to the third verse. It's...
Yeah.
shifted from more devotional to more rejoicing. And in the former LBW, they used a version that changed the tune on that.
Oh,
yes, that's absolutely right.
And it was higher.
You start up in the, I mean, it basically begins with the same gesture, an octave higher, da-da-dum, but, you know, really high, so that the E-flat is where you're lingering for much of that verse. You're absolutely right.
I noticed that they went back to this
kind of thing,
in this
right, yeah, which is mysterious to me. I mean, maybe they wanted to make it sort of seem more like the kind of folk hymn that it is, and they understood that having a sort of rewritten third verse made it seem too highfalutin somehow.
It could just be that it wasn't as approachable for a lot of people at that register.
Perhaps.
Yeah, I like how it shifts to first person, and it gets so personal. And the music kind of changes there too, kind of, I don't know how to describe it, with my face to the rising sun, it's just a beautiful section, I think.
Yeah, it is. It is. And it seems to me that musically, something does go on in the second half of this thing. When I fall on my knees with my face to the rising sun part, something special does actually begin to happen there. I mean, what do we notice, just looking at this thing on the page, about this, the second half of this? I mean, there are certain, and especially as we get into that last line, we notice all kinds of things. It's a rich hymn. But one thing that we do notice is that there are these falling gestures, ba-da-da. Which is to say, we get one in the first line. The first line begins as though it's going to be kind of self-asserting. Let us break bread together. That's wonderful. But then there's this gesture of humility on our knees, which is to say, you know, we got the togetherness, we got this, you know, sort of assertion, sort of launching ourselves up to that G. But then we fall on our knees. Let us break a bread together on our knees, and again we fall. Now, even I am not so overwrought in my kind of musical analyses to say that we have to hear this as text painting. That is, that the on our knees, the falling to the knees, is what's being depicted by this fall. But heck, maybe it is. That is, that we, as we fall to the knees, we fall melodically. Da-da-ba-ba-ba. And what's curious is just how important that sort of falling, ba-ba-ba, three-note kind of idea becomes as the hymn goes by. When I fall on my knees with my face, oh Lord. That is, that sort of falling three-note thing becomes the kind of weird preoccupation of the entire arrangement. As we make our way into that fall on my knees part, I fall on my knees from with my face to the rising sun. And from sun onward through that last system, through two whole bars, somebody somewhere in the texture is doing a ba-ba-bum, ba-ba-bum, ba-da-dum, ba-da-da, doing some version of this sort of falling thing. We have this sort of falling three-note gesture. And I find very fetching the idea that what Sam Young may be providing us there is a way of meditating on just what's humble in this hymn. And in fact, turning it into a hymn about that kind of humility, ba-da-dum, a falling gesture, can become a kind of marker of humility. And we get into this sort of ever spiraling series of these falling gestures. And when do they finally go away? They go away with the pronouncing of the word mercy. Oh, Lord, have mercy. And from that moment on, we are purged of those things. And I guess I find fetching the idea that this is a hymn about understanding that one is caught in these kind of falling gestures, caught in gestures of humility, caught in gestures of self-abnegation, that falling to the knees, turns out, with that kind of tone painting, together on our knees, turns out to be the sort of overriding motif, musical motif of the tune. And that kind of fall is what the tune is all about, but it's the fall from which mercy saves us. Does that make sense at all, or am I just crazy? I mean, it seems to me that the tune becomes so fixated on the fall. Let us finally sing this last verse and just see how this comes out if we keep this kind of thing in mind. Again, this da-dum-bum-bum-bum, this sort of falling three-note thing is introduced in the first line, becomes the preoccupation of the last line, and finally we have to be saved from it with the pronouncing of the word mercy. Lord, have mercy. Let's hear it. Okay, sorry. Now we're ready for you. Here we go. Let us praise God together. Mercy. And this, of course, I mean, I say history doesn't matter. I say who cares about history. This Lord have mercy, Kyrie eleison. This is the only Greek part of the Mass ordinary, as we call it, the only Greek part of the Mass. Kyrie eleison, Christe eleison, Kyrie eleison. Since time immemorial, people have been opening Masses with this prayer, Lord have mercy. And so at the moment that we kind of return to this sort of primal event in the Eucharist, Lord have mercy, we're absolved somehow, absolved musically. It's a lovely thing. Closing thoughts before we press on to, of all things, another Eucharist hymn, which I find in very different ways a stunner. Okay, let's go there. It's a stunner for which we all, I'm an Episcopalian, as I might have confessed already, but we all have the Lutherans to thank for this one. Now the silence on page 460. Now, I don't remember, I don't think this showed up in the LBW. Is Now the Silence in the LBW? I don't recall.
It started in the LBW.
Okay, very good. Do you all sing this thing, Lutherans in the Room? Is this a tune you make use of?
Yeah, in fact, Carl Sharp was here.
Yeah.
Okay. Because it's sang as Billy Boynton Choir. So this was very much in the thoughts of people putting together.
Excellent. Yeah, Carl Schalk and I I feel like we travel in many of the same circles, that he's a nice public figure, kind of public servant of Lutheran hymnody, the author of this tune. Vida and Schalk, the pair, the text writer, the tune writer, also gave us God of the Sparrow, for example, a really neat hymn that even showed up in the most recent Methodist hymnal. All kinds of good stuff has flowed from these people's pens. Let us sing Now the Silence at least once and just see what we see what we make of it. I don't know, maybe just give us the pitches and let us sing our way into it after that. Where's a... So now is where we're gonna begin. Let's just dive right in. This is one of the very few hymns in the book that is not strophic, a word that we've used before to refer to nearly all hymns. In fact, Eric Routley, one of the greatest hymnologists in history, an Anglican, said if something isn't strophic, it's not a hymn. This is for him one of the definitions. By strophic, we mean it has several different sets of words, at least two, sung to the same music. So, Let Us Break Bread Together has three verses, all sung to the same music. We have the same music three times. Well, in the case of Now the Silence, of course we don't. This is what we call through composed, which is to say he starts at the beginning of the poem, runs his way straight through to the end, you know, composing as he goes. And we never stop to repeat things, at least not to repeat them exactly. How does this tune work? I mean, what makes it work as a Eucharist hymn, if indeed it does? How does it help get the words across, boss?
Well, the rising pitch tends to give a feeling of hope and expectation.
Great, great. Expectation how? I mean, hope and, I guess, are hope and expectation the same thing? I suppose they are.
Well, but I'm thinking that way because these are all Eucharist-related hymns, and so
right.
They're looking forward to the Messiah
thoughts. And the rising notes help with that. Anybody want to get on that train or say more?
It's building in a kind of liturgical sense. It begins on a meditative kind of mode and then kind of builds to an action.
Excellent. Yeah, building. And it's curious. I mean, there are tunes that rise of the Father's love begotten, there the world began to be. But there's something beyond sort of rising in this tune. And there is a sense of building. I mean, the bum, 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 bum. This is a very weird way to begin a tune. And we don't have to get to particularities, but these are fourths that we're talking about, two fourths stuck next to each other. Béla Bartók, the early 20th century composer, he could string together fourths this way. But hymn writers, no, they can't. Unless it's really something kind of special thereafter. Bum, 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 bum. This is a strange way to begin a tune. We don't have sort of major, minor harmonies or anything.
It has elements of chant. It also has, I've lost it. I'm used to singing it faster.
Yeah.
So that the rhythm is carrying you along.
Yeah.
And it felt very lethargic and ploddy to me to sing it at that tempo.
And I think I'm the one dictating that tempo because I've always thought it was supposed to go slow. But the couple times that I've heard Lutherans sing it, it has been fast. It's kind of a jolly, rollicking thing.
It's sort of, it has that sense of you do start in this rather strange manner with the fourths, which isn't easy for people to always get into right away.
Mm-hmm.
But it does really have this feeling of, it's not just building up, but it's getting larger.
It's as if you're building to a breathless joy, mm-hmm. really pushing on through.
Yeah.
It has that accelerando built into it.
Excellent.
This was harder for me to sing because I'm not really a choir singer, but and because of that, I noticed there's no bars ending anywhere.
Yeah.
So it as a communion hymn, it sort of tells me I'm going to have to stay focused. I'm not supposed to look at whether Mr. Jones is wearing a red hat to the flag. I'm supposed to concentrate on my Eucharist.
Okay, terrific. You actually have to pay attention to this thing. It's a certain amount of work. I know exactly what you mean, and the fact is I can fairly easily divide hymns into those that are kind of those that are hard to sing and those that aren't, and it isn't necessarily just sort of high versus low or something like that, but you know, there are tunes that just fall so easily out of the mouth that you just don't think about them, and there are others that you think, okay, this is, you know, this is art we're doing here, this is, you know, we're having sort of labor at this, and and that's part of the, that is part of the effect, I think. That's a great observation. Others?
The fourth begin at the beginning, and then the next two, the third and fourth line have also fourths, but they're higher.
Excellent. How much higher?
A fourth.
A fourth, that's right. That is that we begin way down here, bum, 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 and then we get the kind of meta version of that, bum, 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 when, you know, things are taken up a fourth, and we can kind of piece this all together into this weird chain, bum, 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 of interlocking fourths that has nothing to do with the way that hymn tunes are ordinarily put together. It has to do instead with this highly self-conscious sort of leap upward, I mean, as things are kind of carried
up. This is
up.
Probably totally irrelevant, but
I'm
there's
a career
reference
thing.
To wedding in this,
yeah.
And
yeah.
That fourth is the wedding fourth, you know? When you want to think of the distance, you just think of here comes the bride to get a fourth. And it's interesting that we have a wedding in this song.
Wow.
Also.
Yeah. That's an interesting observation.
Like I said, probably nothing to do with it.
Yeah, I mean, I suspect so, but again, my claim is perennially there are no accidents, that if that's what it means to you, if what you're describing is part of what you're hearing, then we can't act like it's not there. I mean, that is, you know, that's part of the experience. Are you musically trained? Did you go to college to study music and stuff, or something?
Yeah.
Because, in fact, I do, I mean, there is a long tradition of using Here Comes the Bride
actually,
to teach, you know.
Yeah, I fought it my whole career, but.
Right, yeah, yeah. But, I mean, but this it's a tune from Wagner's Parsifal, Here Comes the Bride. And, you know, anytime you're trying to sort of inculcate people in, you know, here's a fourth, here's a sixth. My bond, okay, there's a major sixth, my bond, lies over the ocean, isn't that nice? You know, but when you're doing Here Comes the Bride, or a fourth, it's Here Comes the Bride that gets across. Fascinating, you should describe this as coming to roost here in this poor Carl Schott tune, but I think you're absolutely right. I think it's a very interesting dimension. Other thoughts? I mean, it's fascinating, oh, Bjorn.
Sorry, after the, so it begins with the fourth, and then it has another fourth, then it has a fifth. Which sounds a little more happy with the wedding, or at least more normal, more comfortable maybe. And then after that, they don't have any ascending intervals at all. It's, which I think sounds like it just seems to build in how comfortable we are with it and how happy.
Are you talking about
seems.
Heart? The C that we reach with heart? Is that where's the fifth that we're talking about?
Actually, I played the wrong fifth. That is a fourth. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But after that, it goes to more regular things.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, what happens with heart? Something special does happen with the word heart there in line, whatever line that is. Now the heart, the fifth line. Now the wedding, now the song, now the heart forgive. I mean, there's just a very particular kind of musical thing. I mean, there's something special about the word heart. What's special about it? Well, I mean, for one thing, and all I'm fishing for here is it leaps up. Before this point, this has been what we can call a da capo, Italian for back to the head. You know, this is the moment in the hymn when we go back to the beginning and start singing the first part again. Now the wedding, now the song, now the heart forgive. And that's what we expect, but we don't. Heart leaps out at us. Now the heart forgive. So the heart is a new thing. We thought we were home. We thought we knew what this was all about. But suddenly heart, we sort of leap up into the stratosphere. And it turns out to be that leap up about which the entire rest of the tune is concerned, with which it is concerned, which is to say, that leap upward, the heart forgive and leaping, well, leap it did, yeah, we shovel away up to a sea. And that leap is what the rest of the tune is preoccupied with. Now the Spirit visitation, now the Son's epiphany, now the Father. You know, it turns out to be this moment of sort of breaking free with the heart forgiven leaping that we're left with. This is what the music says, okay, we're going to be about this now. We don't want to be about, you know, that place we started. We're about this new place. What happened when the heart was forgiven, when the heart leapt? That's what we're going to leave you with.
In fact, the heart could refer to the sinner. The sinner for given leaping, you know, that moment of acceptance that Jesus died.
Yep, terrific. Yeah, one way or the other, it is very hard in a strophic hymn, that is, if you're saying the same thing, you know, over and over four times with a new set of words each time, it's a very hard thing to achieve this kind of clarity about your denouement, about your telos, about the sort of home that you're grasping toward. You know, the end of this hymn does seem to throw us in a whole new place. And there's something very important, I think, about the fact that it pretends that it's going to repeat itself. So now the silence, now the peace. We have that as our kind of first section. Now the hearing, now the power. That is our kind of middle section. Then back to the first one. Now the wedding, now the songs. Now the heart forgive. And that begins as though it's going to be a repeat. This will be, you know, what the musicologists very cleverly call an ABA thing. This happens, that happens, this happens again. You know, it pretends it's going to be one of those, but no. It turns out that when we have this kind of musical homecoming, it's transformed, that the heart leaps, and with it, the melody is transformed, and it is that sight of the transformation. Ba-ba-bum, 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 that the rest of the hymn is going to be occupied. I can scarcely imagine a more vivid way to talk about being transformed by the experience of the Eucharist. How many of us, quick show of hands, have ever taken Eucharist, taken communion at the Valparaiso University Chapel? Good. Well, then I'll tell you the story. The Valparaiso University Chapel is oriented. We have the table. It is a circular communion table up front. And the walls are organized like this, nice stained glass around the back. But this is essentially how the walls are laid out. So you walk in the door here and you find your seat and you see brick. You see brick walls the whole way. And then, I mean, that is, this is how your line of sight works as you're looking out at these walls. You go up and you take Eucharist and the building is transformed. The building is nothing but windows. You turn around and the whole place is light. You know, because now you're looking out of all the windows. And to me, this is exactly how this hymn works, that somehow the heart forgiven leaps, we get up to this C, and then the C is all we can think about from then on out. And we don't even want to go back to that F. I mean, the piece began, dun-dun-bum, and we understand that F is the home note, it's the tonic, it's where we're going to end up. And we can't even be bothered like that. We've got a new home now. You know, now, it's G that we're going to end up on. It's an amazing tune.
It's like a C major.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's not even the root of the chord. It's this magical place. Right.
There's another thing that I think works with this lack of repetition, and that's the rhythm. It's almost like a train on tracks or a horse galloping. You just have to keep going forward.
Great. Now, why do you suppose... Oh, go ahead.
The rhythm, I think, is interesting. I just I count the meter, 7, 8, which is common. 7, 8, 7, 8, 7, 8, 7, 8. 5 lines. Next line, 8, 7. And the last line, a strange thing. Now at the end, it's hard to parse it. But I looked on page 1201.
Yeah.
See if I could see this and the others. It's not even in here in terms of this meter. It says showing you meter. I thought, well, maybe it's a 4, 3. Instead of the 7. And it isn't, because it just isn't in here. So there's no other tune in this whole book that you could use to put with this. Is the words.
Yeah.
So it's one of a kind.
Excellent.
It's one of a kind.
That's a great observation. You know, I think that's a really nice place to stop. Closing thoughts about this tune. Okay. Well, we have gotten to three hymns, and there are many more that we might have spent time with, but I think it's pretty rare that a hymn that really sticks with us for whatever reason doesn't invite us to some kind of work of this kind, to some kind of meditation on just what the melody does accomplish above and beyond what the words accomplish. And with that, you know, stirring call to action, we will bring things to a close. Thank you all very much, and I hope to see some of you at least tomorrow night. Yes, and thanks to Bjorn, purely here on a volunteer basis.